Welcome to Fuller Butts, a behind-the-scenes plastic surgery podcast. Yes, you heard that right. Join your co-hosts, Dr. Sam Fuller and Dr. Dan Butts, board-certified plastic and reconstructive surgeons, on an exclusive full-access pass into the world of plastic surgery. Combining their expertise and training, Drs. Fuller and Butts will share medical insights, detailed explanations, and lighthearted humor to keep you entertained and informed. We're certain you'll become passionate about the plastic surgery specialty, and between debunking myths, uncovering truths, or just making you laugh out loud at their perspective on this creative and artistic field, we've got something for everyone. From tummy tucks to Botox and mommy makeovers to surgery do-overs, the Fuller Butts podcast will surely satisfy your podcast fix. All right, now let's dive into this episode.
Hello and good day, everyone. It's Dr. Fuller here at Fuller Butts. I'm here with Dr. Butts. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you doing? Heard you had a crazy day.
12 surgeries.
Jeez.
So I took care of a squirrel bite.
Not funny. They have rabies. Don't they have rabies?
She nursed him from her. And then he got out and came back in and was hurt and attacked her. So she
was like trying to save this poor squirrel who was injured.
She was with him for like 2 years, and it's not the first time that he's bit her, but it's the last one. She turned him into the Humane Society.
So what's worse, a Siberian tiger or a squirrel?
It was a snow leopard. And the worst out of all of those was the pit bull dog bite that I had today too.
Oh my gosh, pit bulls are the worst.
So I had to amputate some fingers as a result of a pit bull attack. So a lot of surgeries, tendon transfers, breast scar revisions from out-of-state patients seeking second opinions, skin cancers on the scalp, rotational flaps, skin graft inside the ear, like in the conchal bowl, where I had to wedge it out under local. Then did a full thickness skin graft from the preauricular skin. So just a lot of brain power working on different things. It was exciting. Everybody.
It's an awesome day. Great.
How about you? How was your day?
It was good. Not that exciting. Did a pretty great breast reduction. Took like over a pound on each side. I think she's going to look fantastic and just like feel like literally a weight's been taken off her shoulders. This can be pretty, pretty amazing surgeries for patients. Then another just augmentation with a lift. So yeah, finished that up before lunch and then had a crazy afternoon clinic, just tons of post-ops and a couple consults. But
so what bra size did you guarantee for that breast reduction patient?
I never guarantee a bra size for any surgery. If you go to Victoria's Secrets, everyone's like a D cup. I always talk more about proportions and fitting their frame and less about what that letter might be. We can definitely get them lifted, more proportional, and try to target smaller or bigger, depending on what their goals are. What about you? Do you have a special magic wand for bra sizes?
Oh, no. No, that was just a softball there for you. I do find those to be very satisfying surgeries. One of the my favorite segments is just when you're setting the patient up, having done one side, and you're looking at the one side compared to the other, and like everyone in the room is like, oh my gosh, she's going to be so happy.
Yeah.
Such a dramatic difference. And you think that it's not a big deal, but besides confidence, it's like literal weight off of their chest and their back is, even in the recovery room, they're feeling better. So that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a little sore, but they often just feel like, lighter. Why are we hopping on for a hot topic today? We've been shooting a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so we decided to do a special edition, hot topic edition, because there's been an array of very concerning news reports and situations involving plastic surgery and harm to patients that we felt we should voice our opinions, our perspectives on that, and at least try to educate, inform our viewers on what's happening. And unfortunately, these are not new situations. It's something that's been going on for years, decades, but it doesn't seem to be slowing up. If anything, it's speeding up. And so we wanted to address some of these very recent news reports and situations going on.
Yeah, I think people often describe the cosmetic industry, not just plastic surgery, but you know, all cosmetic procedures, injectables, is kind of the wild, wild west when it comes to marketing, and which is really unfortunate, you know, for the patient. They should know what they're going to get, and these articles really highlight that and the importance of, you know, the marketing campaign of the Plastic Surgery Society over the last decade or so of doing their homework. What was the first one you sent me a couple days ago?
Yeah, so I think it was the solar eclipse day is when he talks about this.
I couldn't read it because my eyes were burning.
So the first article is a mother-daughter combo team that were illegally, inappropriately performing butt injections, and not just butt injections, but silicone injections all over the body. And the mother, who's 56 years old, and her daughter, who's 18 years old, were actually traveling to multiple states based out of Texas. And they were recently caught in a police sting where they were offered $6,000 for their silicone injections into the butt. Ended up giving this undercover cop some sedation medications before they were finally arrested and brought to justice, or at least arrested and facing charges. And now there are multiple women coming out of the woodwork stating on how harmful their injections have been. Now, when we're talking about liquid injections being injected, say, into the leg, you know, because one of these patients had calf injections, or into the butt, what are some possible side effects or issues that patients can suffer from?
Yeah, I mean, if those silicone nodules get infected, they can turn into granulomas or hard nodules and firm, painful masses. And the calf, I think that patient had a lot of like lymphedema, swelling issues, which, you know, lower extremity stuff just does not tolerate anything all that well. So putting foreign objects, foreign bodies in there, just is, you know, a recipe for disaster, especially when not done in a sterile, really proper condition with questionable materials.
Yeah, and apparently upon arrest, they were asking these two individuals like what they were injecting, and they told the police they didn't even know what were in the bottles. And they had bottles that were in the suitcases, were wrapped in saran wrap. They were not English on the prints. And so they were literally injecting something that they were not even familiar with, and certainly not trained, having no medical training. So who should the onus be on as far as, you know, how does, you know, if a viewer or listener is hearing this and wanting to get their lips filled, or they want to have some sort of butt augmentation, like how do they tell the difference between this situation and somebody who's, you know, appropriate for it?
Yeah. I mean, doing their homework is really critical. I think asking questions, which sometimes maybe patients are embarrassed to ask, like, what is your qualification? What's your like, what is your training? Looking at reviews can sometimes be tricky or misleading. You can, you know, so maybe they were, I think some of those people were referred by a friend. So, you know, doing a lot of research and reviews, not just going to their website where they can put whatever they want on it, and looking at where they're trained. Obviously, if it's being done in a garage or someone's home, you got to, you know, ask some questions. Like if you get, you know, that spider scent tingly, like something's not right, you should probably take off. And unfortunately, it really is on the patient in a lot of these situations to be smart and not always look for, you know, the cheapest or what might seem like the easiest solution for a problem, because that can often be the most dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, some of the points that we're going to make at later articles in this podcast, but certainly one for here that I would be saying would be, you know, it's not always about the cost, or you pay for what you get. But in this situation, I mean, paying $6,000,
right,
$8,000, $10,000, that's a lot of money. That's right. Not like a bargain. You're getting that with all of the risk and none of the benefit. And is liquid silicone as an injectable ever a good idea, in your opinion?
No. I mean, years ago, people were using it, but it has been shown time and time again to have a lot of problems, granulomas, infections. It just doesn't go away, and it can migrate. It's pretty much not used, or I think FDA approved in the United States anymore.
Yeah, that's a hard stop for me and for all board certified plastic surgeons. I would commit to. I mean, you should never be excited about getting just liquid silicone injected into your body. That's not okay. That's not what's in breast implants. That's not what's in fillers. And so if we're talking about a lip filler, Dan, what would you be telling our viewers is actually what lip filler is?
Yeah, so the most fillers are all kind of some form of hyaluronic acid, which is a kind of a complex, simple, sugar essentially that your body can break down itself. And there's a agent, hyaluronidase, that can dissolve it if there is a problem as well. So it's great that you can temporarily plump these areas up, restore volume, and not that you want to be dissolving them, but if you need to, there is a way to dissolve it, which there isn't with silicone.
And so, in this news report out of Texas, they had interviewed several patients who had serious issues with these silicone injections, had infections in their butt and their calves, have chronic pain and chronic swelling, as Dan mentioned. There was a patient who had their lips injected with silicone and now just have marble feeling round, hard firmness on their lips that are really challenging to fix. And, that's what they're left with. And unfortunately, this is not the only case. This is happening. And so we just want to alert everyone that you really need to do your homework, be aware, and have that, that spidey sense when it comes to these situations where it seems a little bit shady, or if they're certainly unwrapping their medical product out of a suitcase in your house, you should probably back off.
Really the only solution for those situations is to excise it, which tends to leave more scar tissue and big scars. And even that can be quite devastating. And unfortunately, the next story is, more catastrophic in the terms of you're not just a disfigurement, but, a fatality. So in the LA Times, I guess this happened a year or so ago, but kind of has recently come to the front headlights. There's a lot of news about it, where a 28-year-old female mother of four died while having liposuction, which is just tragic. I think when you really look into what was going on, it was being done by a pediatrician, which is just mind-boggling. What does a pediatrician normally take care of, Sam?
Children,
right.
So it's children, and they're often non-surgical. And so they're taking care of strep throat and blood pressures and growths. And when you look, and take a deeper dive into this situation, this pediatrician was also had created a significant complication requiring an ICU stay in a patient undergoing liposuction a few years ago. And so there were some red flags, some warning signs. And unfortunately, they can escape or they can evade the normal structure of the medical community by, cutting corners and doing things outside of the visibility of the surrounding area. So, Dan, what are some ways that a pediatrician can end up doing liposuction? Like, how does that happen in modern day?
Yeah. So, anyone with an MD can open a private practice and advertise themselves as a cosmetic surgeon. There's really no great regulatory body to prevent them from doing that. And one of the traditional safeguards for doing surgery was hospital credentialing, where the hospital, looks over your submission and make sure you're safe and well-trained to do the procedures you're asking to do. But with liposuction, certain procedures that you can do under local anesthesia in the office, you're able to get away or get around the hospital. So a great way to kind of make sure your doctor has good backup plans is to ask where they're credentialed at the hospital. And if there is a problem, like what hospital would they be admitting you to? You probably have a couple hospital admission in your areas, Dr. Fuller?
Yeah, we were messaging or talking earlier about this because we're discussing how do we inform our patients or educate our listeners on how to ask their surgeon if they have privileges or admitting issues. And I had a patient recently who asked me, and I started listing like four or five hospitals that I could admit to in the area. To me, it's certainly not I can't admit I don't have access to a hospital. I have many hospitals across many different towns and districts. And so that's a huge question to ask. And then, you know, a question that we thought would be important was would be just to ask if the surgeon's board certified, but that also can be very misleading. So, you know, both Dan and I are board certified plastic surgeons, certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery, which is recognized and credentialed in the United States as the premier plastic surgery board. However, there is an alternative board called cosmetic surgery, and cosmetic surgeons can self-label themselves that. And in fact, in this report, in the Wild Wild West, and this pediatrician with this very sad and horrific death of a mother of four, they actually were able to find a huge percent of quote-unquote cosmetic surgeons marketing themselves as such with background training in anesthesiology, in urology, in gynecology, and actually someone who's a phlebotomist whose their training is solely in drawing blood for lab work, and they're marketing themselves as a cosmetic surgeon. So, you know, Dan, what can a patient do? Like, should they... What can they do to feel safe in proceeding with plastic surgery?
Yeah, I mean, researching, like, again, doing their homework, obviously asking those questions. I think, you know, you can straight up ask them, are you board certified in plastic surgery? And some people say, oh, yes, I'm board certified, but you do need to verify. Most surgeons, I'm sure most of your offices, you have a diploma hanging on the wall. When you go to multiple locations, it's hard to, you know, cover all the office spaces with them. Where you're credentialed, asking them how many of this procedure you might be interested in do they do, asking what kind of complications they've had and how they manage those. You know, it's an important thing. And, you know, I remember almost every complication I have because I'm always trying to figure out how I can avoid it in the future. And, you know, they don't happen often, but when they do, we want to fix them as quickly as we can. So those are numbers I can readily kind of, you know, rattle off if needed. What did I miss? Any other key things?
No, I was just reflecting on when you started talking about complications, and in this article, there was the chief of plastic surgery of Loma Linda who stated that in their emergency room, which is in Southern California, 1 to 2 times a week, they are seeing complications from the community by someone practicing quote unquote cosmetic surgery outside of their scope. And so this is something that's very real. One of the former presidents of the American Board of Plastic Surgery was, I think, in the article stating that for every one death that we are talking about in the news, there's 12 to 15 complications that are significant, causing ICU admissions, causing chronic pain, multiple surgeries, infections. And so this is something that's not a one-off or, like, oh gosh, it happens every other year or so. This is frequently happening. And so while we wanted to inform our audience that this is happening, this is frequent, we also wanted to inform them that this is not a panic attack in waiting. There is certainly safe plastic surgery that can be done. It's an exciting field. We're very passionate about that. And if done the right way, it certainly can be a wonderful outcome, such as the breast reduction you talked about earlier, in the right hands. And that's, you know, something that we want to reiterate. You know, certainly we safeguard and want to put patient safety into context in everything that we do, whether it's in-office procedures, whether it's injectables, whether it's surgeries. And so while it's safe, we can't ignore the fact that this is happening. And Dan and I actually spoke about when we were in training in Chicago, we would get calls from Texas asking for transfers from patients who had surgeries done in Mexico across the border. Cosmetic surgeries done cheap, there were complications, major problems, and they were essentially dumped across the border and then either had family or requested to return to Chicago. And then we had to deal with those. And those were devastating. Like, they're scarred or burnt into my brain. People missing their ears from facelifts, having multiple intracutaneous fistulas where the liposuction entered into the abdominal contents, where instead of staying within the fat. So these are dramatic issues that is very frustrating for us because it should be preventative. We shouldn't be responding to the problems. We should be trying to be proactive about it.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess what is board certification? Keep drop saying this, but, like, well, how does one become a board certified plastic surgeon, Sam?
So after 4 years of medical school, you choose to subspecialize. And for plastic surgery, that means completing a 6-year integrated or combined plastic surgery residency where you rotate through all of the specialties. And I'll name as many as I can remember and fill in the ones that I'm leaving out, but that includes breast surgery, breast cancer, cosmetic surgery. It includes craniofacial, which is cleft lip and palate, craniosynostoses, congenital differences. There's hand and upper extremity. There's microsurgery subspecialty, burn surgery, gender reassignment. So we're seeing all of the broad scope of plastic surgery.
Trauma reconstruction. I mean, tons of
trauma. Yeah. And that's the interesting and exciting thing about plastic surgery, just as I mentioned about my 12 cases today, is that we don't own a body part. It's jokingly described as plastic surgery is the skin and its contents, meaning that we need to be aware of everything. And so our training is very broad and arduous. And there are other ways to become a board certified plastic surgeon. You can also complete a full general surgery residency and then a 3-year plastic surgery fellowship afterwards. And then after all that's done, you're still not a board certified.
Right.
Then you get into practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're able to take the test.
Yeah. Then you're able to take a series of tests. One is a written exam, which is lengthy and covers, you know, a lot of the can't miss key fundamentals and principles. And then there's also an oral exam. And so, Dan, what is the board certification process for an oral exam?
Yeah. So the first 9 months of your practice, you collect all of your cases and you know, all the details about them. It's a lot of work. Then you submit them to the board and they pick out 6 that they're called your known cases that you then have to prepare even further with photos and be prepared to you know, discuss them. Then you everyone applying or doing the boards that year flies down to Arizona. I think that's what they still do. I don't know if it's changed with COVID, but, and you to sit around this hotel for how many days is it? 3 days? I don't even remember. It's such a blur.
I think it's on like a Thursday, Friday. I showed up Monday or Tuesday to just study like 8-10 hours just to prepare for these unknown cases across the entire scope, as well as these handpicked cases from your first 9 months of practice.
Yeah, so you go into this hotel room with 2 examiners and they just go through your knowns and then unknowns. And you can only do what? I think it's 2 per room. They just literally open up a file and there's a picture of a mangled hand or a busted face or a breast cancer situation. And they just kind of go through this scenario and how you're going to manage it. And the whole goal is to make sure you're safe, you're sound, you know what you're doing. You're not a cowboy. And make sure that you're going to be an upstanding participant in the plastic surgery community.
Yeah, for sure. And it's very nerve-wracking. And then once you complete the written exam, you complete the oral exam and you receive your diploma, you're still not done. You're still getting annual CMEs. You're still getting continuing medical education. So we're still going to meetings. We're still doing online quizzes and tests, staying up to date because things change and you need to stay up to date with technology and best practices within the field. I was recently interviewed by Authority magazine and they asked for like one of my proudest accomplishments as a surgeon. And for me, at least for this interview, what came to mind was one of my board examiners who was a premier plastic surgeon out of New York. You know, afterwards came up to me and said, "Hey, I actually have family where you practice. I think you did a great job. You know, we should stay in touch." And a few months after the oral board exam, I had flown back to Arizona, was practicing. I got a call when I was in the office saying, "This plastic surgeon's on the phone, wants to talk to you." And I was like, "Oh no, what's happening?" And he actually was asking for a referral for a family member for one of my colleagues and partners. And I ended up treating his mother-in-law twice, both for a skin cancer and also a wrist injury. And so to me, it was very reciprocal and to go, you know, full circle from being quote unquote pimped or to be on the hot seat and to be grilled by someone to be allowed to enter into the American Board of Plastic Surgery. And now to be asked to treat their family members, to me, it was meant that, you know, meant something of tremendous value and just meant like I did it. I made it and people think I'm safe and I'm a good surgeon and so
forth. Totally. Go ahead.
So we're, you know, we're talking about these cosmetic surgeons who are offering to do these surgeries. And so, you know, why would a urologist or why would a gynecologist or a pediatrician be doing liposuction? Like, it seems very obvious, but just to spell it out for our audience.
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly, you know, it can be lucrative. And when this age of continually decreasing reimbursements for insurance procedures, I think they're looking for a way to supplement that and what they might think is a, you know, an easy procedure, not taking into consideration kind of the, some of the, you know, severity and things that can go wrong. So it's, you know, unfortunately kind of a, you know, selfish situation.
And I think that really leads to our last article, our last problem that we want to talk about, which really prompted us just to hop on, you know, later in the day just to, you know, discuss this hot topic. And that, you know, it seems like the butt injectors are using things from across the border and things that are cheaply gained. There are cosmetic surgeons who are trying to cut corners and do things in the office to escape the certification regulations that are there. And we were recently sent an article from the Illinois Department of Public Health warning emergency rooms and medical practitioners of possible counterfeit Botox. And so there's a potential, not just in Illinois, but also in Tennessee, of counterfeit Botox, which is leading patients to have symptoms of botulism. Dan, do you remember any of symptoms of what botulism may cause for patients?
Now you're putting me on the hot seat. I didn't think I was back in the boards. So, I mean, it could be, I mean, it can, if it's really severe, you get, I mean, it's muscle paralysis sort of stuff. So, I mean, weakness, drooping of the face. I mean, obviously, you know, when you're doing it targeted for Botox, you're intentionally paralyzing muscles. But if it's more widespread, I mean, it can cause pulmonary issues, breathing problems. What am I missing?
100%. So you pass. So, you know, shortness of breath, these patients are being hospitalized and they're tracing it back to potentially a nurse who is outside of her scope or authority, possibly obtaining Botox, not from Allergan or from the brand, but from other distributors. And this is to a single individual, and now it appears to be happening in a different state as well. So, Dan, who can inject Botox?
I mean, I don't know. Every state probably has different rules, which kind of can make it messy. But I mean, nurses are often well trained and able to do it. Obviously, plastic surgeons, there's a lot of dentists that can, you know, are doing it. So a lot of people are able and legally able to do inject Botox. And a lot of those can do it safely. But I think when you, you know, again, it's kind of like the mother-daughter duo, finding people that are trying to make, you know, money and cut cost, you find some distributor of some sort of Botox from China, who knows where, and you get, you know, a faulty product that can really harm people.
I usually tell new patients, like, I don't like clients or patients to shop around. And if you're looking for like the cheapest priced product, I'm probably not the guy. And I would want them to be, you know, a lifelong or a loyal patient who's coming back, because we have to understand your face, your musculature, everyone's unique and different. And so for that reason, I really don't do a lot of deals or specials or promotions where I'm cutting the cost drastically for tox for a month or here or there, because I'm not trying to get those people who are trying to sneak in and get something for cheap. I want things to be done well and professionally for that. When we talk about a patient coming in for tox or filler, so, you know, to restore volume to their face, their midface, their lips, what are some questions that the viewer should be asking those type of injectors? Because you already mentioned that a nurse can do it, a PA, a nurse practitioner, a doctor, a dentist. We talked about what we should be asking surgeons as far as, you know, what privileges they have at hospitals. You know, are they board certified? Their before and after pictures. Well, you know, what should they be going in asking for as far as getting toxin fillers?
Yeah, it can be a little tricky. I mean, again, a lot of these nurses, med spas, I mean, they've been doing this for a long time. They can, you know, be very well qualified, but still not have the proper protocols. So they're asking about, again, complications. How do you manage those complications? You know, Botox complications are relatively minor, but still, you know, pretty big nuisance of droopy eyebrows or droopy eyelids or asymmetries, which, you know, go away in a few months. But filler complications can be pretty devastating. What's one of the worst case scenarios with a filler injection?
So the biggest worry or concern that an injector should have, a patient should have, is a vascular occlusion event, or if the filler actually goes intravascularly. And if you've ever seen any, you know, human anatomy books, you know that the face is quite vascular. There's multiple blood vessels in the lips and the cheeks. And so if that were to occur and the filler impedes or occludes, stops the flow to a certain part of the face, that area can necrose, it can swell, it can become painful, it becomes pale, and that needs to be taken seriously immediately. And so there needs to be a reversal agent called hyaluronidase that's refrigerated, that's, you know, nearby, that needs to be in hand. There needs to be a good backup plan, you know, for the injectors. Med spas that I work with, that I'm medical director for, I'm asking, you know, who is your eye specialist that's also on backup, you know, in case.
Why would you need an eye specialist?
For blindness. So if the filler is injected near the eye, you know, whether it's the retinal artery, whether it's gets retrovascular, there can be significant eye issues. And so I always, that's my main question, because that's not something that I'm capable of treating. I'm happy to handle and be available for their concerns, their education, but there needs to be more than just a plastic surgeon. And as I start to browse and peruse other med spas, I'm seeing that there's pediatricians and there's family practitioners that are medical directors. And I just worry, you know, if something was to go wrong, what their protocols are. And maybe they have, you know, keen and clear and concise protocols for things, but, you know, that's super important. And so that's a key question that I would ask. The other, you know, things that, you know, patients may ask for is to, you know, have a, to see the bottle, to see what they're actually injecting. In the case of this counterfeit Botox, like, what are they actually doing? If they're hiding it or coming in with a random syringe, I usually bring the bottle in, because to me it's more about time efficiency, as I'm seeing like 65 people or whatever you make fun of me for. But I'm just drawing it up and I'm talking with them and chit-chatting as I'm measuring it and doing that in the room for that. And then even more so, you know, asking to see, you know, your face sheet or your injection sheet of what you had done, take a screenshot or picture of it just to make sure that, you know, they're being as clear, professional, and documenting things correctly. Did I leave anything out for that?
No, it's all pretty thorough. But yeah, it kind of all comes down to, unfortunately, the you know, onus being on the patient to kind of do a lot of that research to make sure the provider they're seeing is doing it safely.
So Dan, if a couple of questions, would you go, if the money was good, would you go and deliver a baby? Just go do a C-section?
No.
Would you go do like a bladder scope? Just get rid of some kidney stones? The money's really good. They're paying cash. You can do it in the office.
No, there's just no way. I mean, it's like, you know, I like to do what I'm really good at and focus on that. So trying to work outside the scope, it's just not anything I'm interested in.
And so it's, I mean, even from our first podcast, when you were, you know, handing over to your partners cases that you can do, but they do a lot more of, and they do well, I think that just really speaks volumes to the outcomes and being patient first, saying, hey, yeah, I could do this, but my partner can do it better. And I'm the same way for, you know, hand problems and complex elbow things, where I'll send it to somebody down the hallway. And then for cosmetic or, you know, if I don't really do any facelifts, eyelid surgeries, rhinoplasties, I don't want to do a couple a year. I don't feel comfortable in managing all the issues. And so I leave that for the people who should do it well. And I would hope that the managing bodies, the regulatory bodies, the governing policies can change to try to protect patients, instead of having these significant outcomes, having these deaths, these complications, you know, to have a police sting to try to catch someone.
Right.
You know,
that's wild.
It makes for a hot topic and a fun, interesting podcast with very significant details. But at the end of the day, I would love to be talking about something else.
Right. Well, yeah, I think that's hit on a lot of important topics and, you know, good to get out there. But yeah, thanks for tuning in. I'm sure this is kind of off our normal list, but we'll get it out there as soon as we can. And we'll be back soon.
Dan, one last question. Is plastic surgery safe?
It's very safe in the right hands. Find a board certified plastic surgeon.
Any other hot topics that our listeners have, viewers have? We've already, actually one of our listeners sent us one of these articles, which kind of started this, which so I really applaud them and appreciate that. Any other hot topics you guys want us to discuss, feel free to reach out to us. You can direct message us on Instagram. I'm S Fuller Surgery MD. And Dan, where can we find you?
Daniel.
Awesome. Shout out to Igloo and Hartley for giving us our intro and outro music. And we'll see you next time on Fuller Butts, Behind the Scenes Plastic Surgery Podcast.
And we're out.
Woo. Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of Fuller Butts, a Behind the Scenes Plastic Surgery Podcast. Doctors Fuller and Butts are so appreciative of your time and attention. We invite you to subscribe, share, and continue to enjoy our plastic surgery perspective. Feel free to reach out on Instagram at either S Fuller Surgery MD or at Daniel Butts MD. That's Butts with a Z for comments, suggestions, and support. Remember, be artsy, stay scientific, and make life fun. We hope you'll join us again on the next episode of Fuller Butts.